It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, why we still love Lucy, the hominid fossil that shook up the way we think about human origins.
First, we're celebrating Women's History Month, which takes place every year during the month of March.
Our next guest says the field of home economics was instrumental in getting women involved in higher education and public life. She's here to explain how such a seemingly retro field advanced women's rights and how a three-decade-long public radio show here in Wisconsin fit into the bigger picture.
Erica Janik is a historian and author of several books and the executive producer of Wisconsin Life. Her latest book is called Marketplace of the Marvelous. Erica, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So when we think of home economics, sometimes we think of, you know, sort of an old school idea, people in the kitchen trying to make a science of home economics, which it is. But this is also, it has strong ties to women's history and in a certain sense, the women's movement. How did that play out?
Absolutely. I think the common image of home economics, you know, you think about people caring for, you know, an egg as though it were their baby or a flour sack baby. But home economics actually has a pretty progressive past. In the 19th century, there were a lot of different forces that were at work that kind of led to the creation of home economics. But part of it was kind of applying science to the home to make women's lives easier and more efficient. And there were a number of different kind of competing interests among people that were looking into home economics and were interested in making it an academic field. Were they really just trying to make women better housemakers? Were they actually trying to provide higher educational opportunities for women? Or were they trying to make women's lives easier so that hopefully they'd have time for something else in their life besides just caring for their families and cleaning up the house? And so all of these interests are kind of at play in the formation of home economics. And it was really a field that was designed by women for women and gave women real educational opportunities that were before then not really available to them.
I mean, a piece you wrote, you talk about what was going on here in Wisconsin at universities and colleges and on the air. Can you tell us a little bit about the Homemakers Program?
Yeah, so WHA, what we now know as
our
Wisconsin
ancestor,
Public.
Yep.
That's right. So they had a program called the Homemakers Program. And it really began in about 1929. There had been a number of kind of farm and home programs throughout the 1920s. But in 1929, they decided to do a kind of dedicated program for women. And radios were becoming very popular, very widespread. Lots of people had them. You know, people didn't have maybe other forms of technology, but radios were something that people were willing to invest in. And with women home during the day, you know, taking care of things around the house, women seem like a natural audience for radio programs. And so they created the Homemakers Program. And for the first couple years, there were just kind of some students and faculty from the UW Home Economics Program who would be on the air. But then in 1933, they actually hired a permanent host, and her name was Aileen Hazard. And she had grown up on a farm in Iowa, and she was chosen to be the main voice of this program. And she really became its guiding force for more than 30 years. And this program was on 6 days a week for an hour every single day. By the time she retired, she actually had done 10,000 shows.
I mean, wow.
That's incredible. And she did all kinds of really innovative things on the air because she was really just trying to reach women all over the state. They were really trying to get home economics to people. You know, you didn't have to go to the university to learn how to make your home life more efficient.
And it sounds like here in Wisconsin, there were some pretty major advances in the field of home economics, including the concept of the triangle in the kitchen, how to maximize your efficiency.
So there were all kinds of people, home economists, that were doing all kinds of studies of efficiency and how to make, you know, how to make your kitchen work better for you. And so home economists here in Wisconsin were studying that. They were studying that actually all over the country. You find people doing kind of motion studies. I don't know if you ever read the book Cheaper by the Dozen. It was one of my favorite books when I was a kid. But, you know, it's about 12 kids. But the parents actually were very famous, Frank and Lillian Gelbreth. They were very famous for doing all kinds of motion studies. And the book is kind of, you know, how they applied these efficiency lessons to their children. But she would do all kinds of things. The mother in that of, you know, watching a woman make dinner and count how many steps she was taking between, you know, the icebox to the stove and then to the table. And then they were moving appliances around and, you know, really just trying to figure out how to save women time and energy because, you know, housework was a lot of work. And, you know, they really wanted women to be able to kind of take a break. And there were kind of different ideas of what women could actually do with that free time. You know, some people said, you know, they'll have their free time and then they can just devote more time to their husbands and children. And other people said, you know, with all of that free time, they'll actually be able to, you know, take some time for themselves. But in all these cases, it was all about kind of bringing technology to women.
So how did all this play out on the Homemakers program in those 10,000 hours? What kind of questions were they answering on this show?
All kinds of things. You know, Aileen Hazard really saw that homemaker as doing everything around the house. This wasn't the only homemaking program in the country. You find homemaking programs all over the place, but they were really popular in the Midwest because we had a largely rural population. And some of these other programs were very specific, like there would be a sewing program or there would be a program about house cleaning. But she really covered everything from how to make tea, how to serve it, you know, how to make clothes, child rearing. She would bring in all kinds of experts from the university. She would do one-on-one interviews. She would have round tables. There's all kinds of pictures of her, you know, sitting at a big table with like six different people at mics.
Wow.
And they're all having a conversation about some home topic. And then one of the other really innovative things that she did is she actually went out in the field. She called them on the spots. And in 1935, I think, is the first year, she actually went to visit a Madison woman in her garden. And she was taking the microphone and walking around the garden and giving her listeners a tour of the garden on the spot. And she ends up doing this many, many times over the years. She goes to people's workplaces and learns, you know, how you make cheese, how they do maple syrup. During World War II, when more women were actually in the workplace, she went to all of these different places around Madison and talked to women about what it was like to do their job and how they managed to, you know, work this job as well as raise their family and cook food and keep their house clean. She was really looking at that idea of kind of work and family balance.
Oh, sounds like she was really ahead of her time, but also really creative too, because she used different techniques to get at this material. And some of this was dramas, right?
That's right. Soap operas were really one of the most popular forms of entertainment, particularly on the radio in the 1930s. And so the Homemakers program, you know, kind of seeing the trends that were going on, decided that they would convey some of their information in the form of a soap opera. And she actually had a family, the Stevens family. And, you know, there was a brother and a sister and a fiance, and they had varying levels of home skills. And so she would create all of these radio dramas, she and along with some of the students in the home economics department, and they would act them out. And one of my favorites has to do with frozen peas. They are talking about how, you know, frozen food is new and people don't really know, should we use this? You know, it sounds kind of silly today, like so many of us use frozen food and are not afraid of it. But it really was kind of a new thing and people didn't understand, you know, was this healthy? How did you even use it? And so she created a drama where the daughter who has grown up with a mother who is very skilled in homemaking, and then her brother and his fiance, she's not so sure about how this works. And so they're kind of walking her through the steps of how you do it. And, you know, it's a little bit hokey, as you might imagine a soap opera being, particularly on the radio. It's a little hammy, you know. They're like, these peas sure are good. There's lots of things like that. But they're very fun. And they did them for many years about all different kinds of topics because they were really trying to make new technology, new innovations seem familiar and you know, make sure that people weren't afraid to try them.
Erica, thanks so much for joining us. That was Erica Janik, historian, author of several books, and executive producer of Wisconsin Life. Her latest book is called Marketplace of the Marvelous, The Strange Origins of Modern Medicine.
Even if you don't know much about paleoanthropology, the study of our human and pre-human ancestors of the distant past, you've probably heard about the fossil Lucy. At over 3 million years old at the time of her discovery, Lucy was the oldest hominid fossil ever found. I think there's some older ones out there now, but she's still probably the most famous.
Donald Johansson joins us now. He's the paleoanthropologist who discovered Lucy back in November of 1974. His discovery permanently changed scientists' ideas about who we are and where we come from. Donald joins us in studio now. He's speaking tonight at the Overture Center in Madison at 7:30. Donald, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here to be able to celebrate Lucy's 40th birthday.
Well, it's been about 40 years, but can you take us back to that day when you first discovered Luce? I understand it sort of started on a hunch of yours.
Well, I actually was looking in northeastern Ethiopia in a place called the Afar Triangle. I knew there were fossils there. There were elephant fossils, monkey fossils, gazelles, and so on, and I was hoping to find fossils of our ancestor. I was in camp on a Sunday morning. My graduate student said, we've got to go out to the site and record on a map the exact spot where a beautiful pig skull had been found. I didn't want to go out. I did. And as we were walking back to my Land Rover, I glanced over my right shoulder and spotted a small piece of arm bone, your elbow bone, actually. And that led to 40% of a 3.2 million-year-old human ancestor who came to be nicknamed Luce.
At this time, this is 40 years ago, did you know right away what a big deal this was going to be for the search for human origins?
Well, I knew that she was older than 3 million years because the geologists were able to date a volcanic horizon. I knew she was fairly complete. I knew she was a she because she was so small. If you took the length of her thigh bone, she was only about 3.5 feet tall. Someone asked on the expedition, well, maybe it was a child. And we looked at her teeth, and she had adult teeth. So I knew that this was important because at that time in the study of human origins, or that tongue twister, paleoanthropology, all the fossils older than 3 million years would fit into the palm of your hand. So this was, I knew, an incredibly important fossil. I didn't know how important. I didn't know that she would be a new species. And I didn't know, most importantly, that she would rewrite the shape of the human family tree.
And you call her Luce. Where did that name come from?
Well, we had a member of the expedition. We were celebrating that evening, and we were all listening to a Beatles tape. And Luce in the Sky with Diamonds was playing. And Pamela said, well, if you think it's a female, we should call her Luce. And I thought, well, I'm a University of Chicago PhD. I don't give cute little names to my fossils. But by the next morning at breakfast, oh, we're going back to the Luce site? How old do you think Luce was when we found her? You think Luce, there'll be more of Luce, et cetera, et cetera. So she got that nickname, and it has stuck ever since.
You mentioned the family tree and a changing picture. What's the argument, Ben, over how we place Luce in the human and, I guess, pre-human family?
Well, what a great question, because Luce was placed at the bottom of a Y that led to several lineages, lines of humans that died out. They were given another tongue-twister name, Australopithecus. Mm-hmm. And I've also postulated since 1979 that she was an ancestor to the human genus, Homo, which is Latin for man, which is us. We're Homo sapiens, supposedly wise man, but I listen to the same news you do. And so she was the last common ancestor to those lineages that led to us and a whole series that died away. And that was quite different because there was another candidate at that time that we now know is on a side branch and ultimately met the grim reaper of evolution, extinction.
Hmm. And there was some controversy at the time. Even though you had made this discovery, it sounds as though, you know, none other than a Leakey said, no, I don't think you really found what you thought you found. And it took some while for science to sift and winnow and get to what her place truly was.
Well, this is the process of science, I think, and statements like this are made, discoveries are made, whether it has to do with global warming or it has to do with who our ancestor was. And it does take time for this new evidence to filter through the scientific community to be evaluated. But today, there's very little controversy that Luce was a new species, Australopithecus afarensis, that she does occupy this place on the family tree, and she did live 3.2 million years ago.
So one question in our early ancestors related to brains versus walking. Did our bigger brain come first or walking upright come first? Did Luce help tip the scales on that one way or the other?
She certainly did, because when we examined her pelvis and her knee and her ankle, all the signs of upright walking. We do this every day. We don't think about it as something unique. But we're the only mammal on the planet that walks around on two legs. All other animals are much more reasonable and walk around on four legs. They don't fall down and trip and fall on their faces and so on. But it is a unique mode of locomotion. And it is something that distinguishes us, as I said, from all other primates, apes and monkeys and all other mammals. And looking at her what's called postcranial skeleton, her pelvis and hip and so on, she was walking upright. But when you look at her brain, we didn't have much of her skull. We had just the back portion that allowed us to fit a good-sized orange into it. So she had a brain that was about the size of the cup of coffee you have in the morning. Our brains are four times that size. So she was really the ape that stood up. She had a very small ape-like brain, but she did walk in a manner almost identical to ourselves today.
Now, at the time, as I understand it, she was the oldest hominid fossil that had been found, and certainly one of the most complete, as you said, and that's not the case anymore. Can you catch us up on what we know today about where humans came from and where Lucy fit into that picture?
Oh, my goodness. If we had a couple of hours, it would be easy. There are other fossils that go back to as much as 6 million years when individuals were walking upright, so this seems to be a cardinal feature for what it means to be placed on the human family tree. There are other fossils at 4.4 million. We're not sure exactly where they fit in the family tree because they have a large mixture of ape and human-like features, but we're probably spending much more time in the trees than Lucy. And then there's a wonderful baby at 3.3 million years found by an Ethiopian colleague of mine, and that's one of the wonderful things now in Ethiopia. We've trained a whole series of scientists who are taking over the research in that country. And this baby at 3.3 million years old has a complete skull and face and most of the backbone and ribs, parts of the shoulder blades, and is really quite wonderful.
A thing that amazes me in hearing this story is, A, parts of these pre-people survived 3-4 million years, A, and B, you found them. How is there a sense of how to find a likely environment? How do you know where to even start looking?
Sure. I mean, this is one of the things people say. What was the most astonishing thing about finding Lucy? I jokingly say we didn't even know she was missing. But the point is that, yeah, they have to die in the right place. She lived and died by a lake, fell into the lake, or was dragged in by a crocodile. We don't know. And her bones began to mineralize and turn into stone. And there were additional sands and clays and silts that covered her and preserved her there for 3.2 million years of anonymity. And then 3.2 million years later, a scientist like myself who was specifically looking for human ancestor remains came along and looked over his shoulder and realized what that bone was. But if I'd looked to my left, I would have missed her. And it was fortunate that I looked to my right.
And you mentioned Ethiopia and what an important site it's become for paleoanthropologists, you know, like yourself who are studying human origins. Why that site? What makes that such a fertile spot?
What makes it a fertile spot is the Great Rift Valley, a structure that runs all the way from Mozambique in the south right on up to where Africa intersects the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. And this was brought about by earth movements creating rivers and lakes. Animals fell into them. The movement is still going on today and resurrecting those ancient sediments and through the process of erosion, eroding these fragments back out onto the surface of the ground.
As you watch what's going on and participate in science going on today, what are you most excited about in circa 2015 paleoanthropology?
Well, in 2015, I'm very excited about something I can't talk about because I'm embargoed. But tomorrow, everybody will hear on National Public Radio and read in their newspapers about a rather stunning discovery that is being announced by the Institute of Human Origins, where I work in Arizona, and will add, I think, some clarity to the family tree. But in 2015, 2016, we are continuing to find fossils in Ethiopia. We have expeditions in the field as we speak. And important nuggets of our ancestry are being collected, evaluated, and fitted into what is the story of how we became human.
Wow. Well, can we have you back on tomorrow? Maybe not. Well, what do you think is left in terms of these big pictures for the next generation? I mean, are we at the point, you know, sometimes they say in certain fields, physics is complete. Paleoanthropology, where is paleoanthropology today?
Well, there's an enormous amount of work to do. There are lots of fossil fields in the Rift Valley stretching up to the country of Eritrea, for example, probably places in other parts of Africa, were like Sudan, for example, which has not been surveyed greatly. There are new fossil discoveries being made on a regular basis in South Africa. So on the discovery side, there are still many things to discover. In the lab, you know how as students we didn't like to do our homework? Well, you can become a professor, and you don't like to do your homework either. You'd rather go out and find the fossils. So we have a storehouse full of specimens, skulls, jaws, teeth, bones, and so on, that really need to be evaluated and reevaluated in some instances using new technology. There's an article coming out shortly about a reconstruction of a mandible or a lower jaw that's been known since 1960, yet it's taken this long for someone to kind of piece it all back together. And so there's lots and lots to do.
You've been at this for a long time, at least 40 years. What drives you? What excites you about the questions of human origins?
Well, I think it's a central question, the essential question we all ask our mothers or fathers, where did I come from? We're given an answer sometimes about a stork or whatever, all sorts of different ideas of creation stories. But the scientific story is one that's still unraveling. And to understand our origins, for me, is particularly important because it helps us understand our place in nature. And if there's anything we can say, it was Mother Nature who really crafted who we are today. And with that perspective, I think, I hope that we will develop a kinder attitude to the natural world around us.
And Donald, as we wrap up, you're known as a great communicator, an ambassador for the field of paleoanthropology and human origins. Why is it so important to you to communicate not just to other scientists in your field, but to everybody, to your human family here, about what you're doing and why it matters?
Well, first of all, my excitement. I am so excited about my field, I sort of want to tell everybody. And I think everybody deserves to be able to understand science, be able to translate that science so that everyone can understand where their tax dollars are going, how science works, how it applies so much to the world we live in today, and whether it's a story of climate change or human origins or technological breakthroughs, we need to help people understand that science is the future. It is something that helps us evaluate our place in this universe.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Donald Johansen, a paleoanthropologist best known for his discovery of the 3.2-million-year-old fossil dubbed Lucy. He's also the author of several books, including Lucy's Legacy.
He speaks in Madison at the Overture Center tonight at 7:30. The House of Representatives passed a bill this afternoon that will keep the Department of Homeland Security funded up to September, the end of the current fiscal year.
The bill passed without any restrictions on immigration and is seen as a victory for President Obama, whose executive action on immigration has been at the center of the weeks-long battle over Homeland Security funding.
With us now is Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, representing Wisconsin. He serves as chair of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rob. Hello, Veronica. How are you doing?
Well, we're good. So this bill just passed the House. What's the sentiment among you and your colleagues over on the Senate side?
Well, I'm happy it did. I've been voting consistently to fund the Department of Homeland Security in such uncertain times with the threats we face. I certainly did not want to see the department not with full funding. But I do recognize the fact that it was President Obama that introduced immigration reform into Department of Homeland Security's funding, and he really poisoned the well, as Leader McConnell and Speaker Boehner had talked about, and that was unfortunate. But again, I've been consistently calling to have the thing funded, and I'm glad it has been.
Now, that executive action on immigration was the sticking point. People in the House and some in the Senate wanted to pass a Homeland Security funding bill that struck funding for that portion of immigration. Democrats on your side effectively blocked that. If you could have gotten the votes, would you rather have passed a Homeland Security funding bill that limited those executive actions?
Well, absolutely. I think every Republican, again, wanted to fully fund the legal and essential elements of Homeland Security, but we had a real problem with President Obama changing immigration law, which a federal district court judge in Texas has ruled that he's done that. So, you know, from my standpoint, when the courts got involved, and I think it's appropriate they did, pretty much that this issue would be decided in the courts, and I think that's appropriate. And so it's certainly the moment when I said, okay, let's let the courts decide this. Let's fund the department.
Will you try in the Senate to pass a separate bill? There'd already been a vote on it, or an attempt to pass it. Would you want to still try to pass a separate measure targeting those executive actions?
Yes, because, again, President Obama, 22 times, I think, prior to taking that executive action, said he did not have the legal authority to do that. And when he took the this action, he said he was changing the law. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows the president or gives him the authority to change, enact, or repeal laws. I mean, his job is to faithfully execute the law, and of course, that's what a federal district judge in Texas has ruled. This will go through the court process now, and they will, in the end, decide the legality of his actions.
The president, the White House, have argued that they do have the legal authority to do this. Part of it is prosecutorial discretion. They get to pick who they try to deport first, that they have the ability to, and this is the part that the judge you mentioned had a problem with, to take positive actions as well. Do you think that the courts ultimately might rule against you on this one?
They may, but if you read the 123-page opinion of this judge, I haven't read the entire thing, but I've read a very detailed summary of it. It's very well-reasoned. And again, there's no doubt about the fact that the Department of Homeland Security does have that prosecutorial discretion and has been using that discretion literally for decades. The departments in both administrations have been doing so. But when you start changing the law by actually issuing work permits, when you start issuing Social Security cards, which are permanent card, supposedly addressing a temporary situation, that's going far beyond prosecutorial discretion. That's actually a positive action, as the judge ruled, and that's changing the law, which the president has no authority to do. And again, we all take an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution. Somebody has to stand up for the co-equal branches of government so that we maintain that delicate balance. If not, we put our freedom and liberties at risk. So I think it's very appropriate for Congress to certainly make an issue of this and do everything we can to restore that delicate balance that President Obama, in numerous cases, through his executive overreaches, is threatening.
Some of your colleagues, House Republicans, had said the fight should have been kept up. You should have fought harder and risked what people have described as a shutdown or partial shutdown of Homeland Security. You, I believe, suggested that this wouldn't really be a shutdown. A lot of vital services would still go on, which they would have, with some unpaid staff, some other furloughs. That being the case, why not take the fight further and risk that partial shutdown?
Because we are under very serious threat of terrorist attack in this country. We've seen it in Paris and Copenhagen and Sydney and Ottawa, in Fort Hood, Texas. So these are perilous times. So this is no time to risk the security of our nation, the health and safety of Americans, over a political dispute. Again, this is being taken over the court. It's a legitimate dispute. It's one that needs to be fought. But I don't think we should be using the funding of the Department of Homeland Security as a tool in that fight.
Do you think this showdown over immigration and Homeland Security has been distracting Republicans, the Republican majority in both chambers, from other top priorities, jobs, health care, that sort of thing?
Well, again, both Speaker Boehner and Leader McConnell asked President Obama not to unilaterally act because they said it would poison the well, and it did. And I've experienced that firsthand as I was discussing actually taking up a border security immigration enforcement law. One of the things I was talking about is, if you really want to secure the border, we should reduce the incentives for illegal immigration, the greatest incentive being people coming here based on work opportunities. And so I was suggesting, let's, as part of a border security bill, include a guest worker program, in many respects administered by the states, where they could set the quotas, they could set prevailing wage rates, get the states involved. And that was actually gaining traction. I was talking to a number of colleagues that I think had a flexible and open mind to that. But when President Obama took that unilateral action, it did poison the well. And quite honestly, those discussions ceased. And that's a real shame. So President Obama has claimed he wanted to fix the immigration problem. He said he would do it in his first year when he had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. He did not do so. And he said, again, 22 times, he didn't have the authority to do what he did. He said he changed the law when he was took this executive action. So these are serious constitutional issues. This is overreach by this executive. It's an issue that we should certainly challenge the president on if we're going to maintain our freedoms.
The other big news in Congress today, Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to a joint session. What did you take away from that speech?
It was an extraordinary speech. I think it took courage on the part of Prime Minister Netanyahu to come over to America, particularly when this administration, I think inappropriately, was highly critical of him and use this as a wedge between our two nations. Israel, the state of Israel, views what's happening with the negotiations with the Iranian nuclear program as an existential threat. I agree with them. So you have the prime minister of the state of Israel so concerned about what this administration is doing in their negotiations with Iran that he felt pretty well compelled to make his case to the American public, because it is this president, this administration, that is barreling forward with negotiations that I think not only threaten Israel, but threaten the region and world peace, and are going to lead, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said. He's not trying to block a nuclear program. He's paving the way for a nuclear weapons program in Iran. So I think it was very appropriate. I think it was a powerful speech. I hope it had the type of effect that will hopefully lead to the support of a pretty simple bill coming out of Congress, which is just going to require any deal that President Obama does with Iran to be voted up or down by the United States Congress. I think it's fitting and proper that that happens, because any deal that Iran strikes, the Iranian parliament will ratify.
The goal of the negotiations is to, from the United States side, prevent Iran from ending up with nuclear weapons. Is there a chance that congressional interference, as the president, I think, has described it, would jeopardize successful negotiations that would do just that?
Well, first of all, the negotiation was pretty well lost at the onset when President Obama relaxed the sanctions, which brought the Iranians to the table, and at the same time pretty well changed the policy of the world toward Iran's nuclear program. Prior to this, we had multiple UN resolutions that called for the suspension of uranium enrichment on the part of Iran. And as part of these negotiations, we basically implied that Iran could continue to enrich uranium. And then it just became a question of how many centrifuges they were going to allow Iran to continue to operate. And now it's getting to an almost ridiculously high number. And we're talking about not really preventing a nuclear weapons program for Iran, but just trying to manage one. So there is no chance, from my standpoint, of a successful negotiation. President Obama lost this negotiation before it even began, and this is a threat to the region, to the threat to Israel, and it's a threat to world peace.
What's the alternative to negotiation in this instance? I mean, not negotiating would open the door, I suppose, to Iranian nuclear weapons programs, military intervention. What do you see as the alternative to this ongoing negotiation?
Well, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, the alternative isn't a bad deal or war. The alternative is a bad deal versus a good deal, and a good deal would actually honor those UN resolutions and require the dismantling of their nuclear capabilities. So, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu said if Iran wants to be treated like a normal country, it needs to act like a normal country. It needs to stop being the primary state sponsor of terror. And so what we should have done is we should never have relaxed the sanctions that brought Iran to the negotiating table in the first place. And I guess the only way to get a good deal is we're going to have to reconstitute those sanctions, and we'll have to force Iran to behave as a normal country, stop their sponsor of state terrorism. And, of course, one of the complicating features in here now is because of President Obama's historic blunder of pulling a stabilizing force of American military personnel out of Iraq. That situation spun out of control. It allowed the rise of ISIS from the ashes of what was al-Qaeda in Iraq. And now Iran is one of the powers that is actually battling back on ISIS. And I think this president realizes if we're going to battle ISIS, we almost need Iran. So, again, it's an incredibly complex situation. But so much of it is the result of lack of resolve, lack of leadership on the part of this administration.
Briefly, I know we're just about out of time, speculation about a rematch, Russ Feingold against Ron Johnson in 2016. Your thoughts?
Well, no matter who I will face, I'll be facing somebody from the Democratic Party, and as Chuck Schumer has labeled the Democrat Party the party of government. And I think what Americans have seen, certainly in the last 6 years, is that a larger, more intrusive government that is spending our and mortgaging our children's future, that is not creating the kind of security that Americans are facing. I don't think big government sells too well. So no matter who it is, it's going to be a contest. Somebody who really supports and wants to grow this dysfunctional federal government versus somebody like myself who really does understand that it's, you know, long-term, you know, good-paying, long-term, self-sustaining jobs actually create in the private sector, and we should do everything we can to make it easier for people to create jobs and build a strong middle class.
Senator Johnson, thanks a lot for taking the time.
Have a great day.
You too. That's Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. According to Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Secretary Kathy Stepp, there could be a new proposal on the table to help the agency operate without tax support, one that would involve selling the naming rights to Wisconsin's state parks.
The proposal comes amid other significant proposed changes to the DNR, including the elimination of 66 positions and a halt to conservation land purchases. And while naming rights for parks is just a possibility at this point, Stepp said she'd like to gather input in the coming years about that idea.
And we want to know what you think. Should state parks be able to sell their naming rights in order to help them be financially solvent, to raise needed money for the parks? Or do you see this as something that should be completely off the table? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in now, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Craig, a contributor already on the Central Time Facebook page, Craig writes, no, for so many reasons, starting with the fact that they already have names. And Tim wrote in, hey, honey, want to go hiking at Pick and Save State Park? How about you? Should we sell naming rights maybe to corporations for Wisconsin state parks and natural areas? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. While your calls are coming in, one more comment. Patrick writes, that would be a slap in the face to some of Wisconsin's historical figures. Think of the Richard Bong Recreational Area or Governor Thompson State Park, etc. We'll go to your calls now. Dan is on the line in Wausau. Dan, hi. What do you think about this?
Well, I'm really not in favor of it. I'd like to know how much money they're looking for, and if they're really that shortchanged, maybe they should talk to our governor and they could take some of his campaign funds and use it instead.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234 as we look at this idea floated so far, not an official proposal in the works, the idea of selling naming rights for state parks. 800-642-1234. Keegan is next in Waupaca. Keegan, hi.
Hi. Hello. I think the selling the naming rights is a great way to fund the department, but I do think we need to do something to honor and continue with the historical names.
So how do you see that work? I know sometimes sports stadiums have something field at something stadium, where one's the corporate name, one's the historical name. Are you thinking of something like that?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they already do it with ballparks, so... Oh.
All right, Keegan, interesting twist on that. Thanks a lot for calling in. I will go now to Kay in Madison. Kay, hi.
Well, I think it's a stupid idea. I can't see going to Chevy Park or Ford Park or something or Chevy Devil's Lake Park. It just seems cheap in the whole idea of a park system. And I think Wisconsin is famous for its parks. And this is just one more way of chipping away at its reputation.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your thoughts. Bob is with us next in Appleton. Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. The comments I have about what I've been hearing about Governor Walker doing the trying to rename the parks and wildlife areas, I think that's the wrong thing to do. Basically, we are, as the one caller had stated, we are noted for having pristine parks. And it would be kind of interesting to have our first park, state park we ever had was Interstate Park over in the northwestern part of the state. Well, what are they going to name it? Miller Park? Coors Park? I mean, I can understand doing that for stadiums, but for state parks and wildlife refuges, I mean, are we that tight with the Pittman-Rodman Act that we can't afford to do this, because sports people pay for that right for us to have that.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Looking at the idea of naming rights, selling them for state parks. Nathan is with us next in Waukesha. Nathan, hi.
Hi. I just call him to say I'd rather go to a park named after Chase Bank or some other corporation than not have a park at all due to lack of funding.
So you think you wouldn't mind seeing a different name on the state park as long as the money came in and kept it operating?
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather have a park there than not have a park there because we're too concerned with what it's called.
All right, Nathan, thank you so much for that call. You can keep sharing your thoughts, keep the conversation going over at the Central Time Facebook page, asking your thoughts on the idea of selling naming rights for Wisconsin's state parks.
Clergy abuse victims and the Milwaukee Catholic Archdiocese go back before a federal bankruptcy judge tomorrow. A hearing in Milwaukee could determine whether many people who say they were physically abused with while children will remain in the church bankruptcy case. It's the latest crossroads in the now four-year bankruptcy battle. Chuck Kornbach looks at that dispute in a story that contains graphic language.
It was early January of 2011 when Milwaukee Archbishop Jerome Listecki held a news conference announcing the 10-county archdiocese was filing for bankruptcy. Listecki said bankruptcy protection would be the best way to allow the church to continue to provide services to parishioners while also dealing with the many unresolved claims brought by clergy abuse victims in molestations dating back as far as the 1960s. Often during the 50 months since the declaration, the debate in the bankruptcy courtroom has been bitter, and those involved say it's the longest-running Catholic Church bankruptcy in the U.S.
Repent and believe in the gospel.
You wouldn't know the case is contentious from the way the Archbishop calmly presided over an Ash Wednesday Mass at Milwaukee Pius High School last month. Listecki also sang.
Amen, amen, amen.
In his house, about a mile west of Pius High School, Mark Salmon has also been trying to go about his usual activities.
Depending on the weapon, athletes either slash or poke to tally up points as long as they hit the correct body part.
Salmon watches a television sportscast the same way any other lifelong sports fan might. But lately, the 61-year-old says he's been again thinking about being one of the 575 clergy abuse victims with claims in the Milwaukee bankruptcy case, stemming from Salmon being sexually assaulted by a church employee as a youth. Salmon says for a while he had to tune out of the four-year bankruptcy dispute because he says the church is playing hardball.
You know, being molested, gnarly raped, and sodomized, that was the easy part. But this last 4 years, you know, dealing with the hierarchy of the Catholic Church has been traumatic in itself.
The going may get even tougher for some of the victims at Wednesday's hearing, as the Archdiocese is pushing to have several categories of claimants removed from the bankruptcy case. Peter Isley is Midwest director of the Survivors Network of those abused by priests. Isley says what the church is attempting is wrong.
And so each one of these victims, this isn't about whether they were sexually assaulted or raped by a priest or whether it was covered up. This is about throwing their cases out because for various legal reasons or technicalities, the Archdiocese is saying under bankruptcy law, we shouldn't have to provide any kind of restitution or compensation.
The Archdiocese has made a settlement offer to about 125 clergy abuse victims, but Isley says the sum being offered is way too small. He also says the amount is far less than the roughly $20 million the Archdiocese has racked up in legal bills from its lawyers. During a recent interview at Marquette University, Archbishop Listecki, who's also an attorney, defended the expenses.
The lawyers, those are my brothers in the law, so, you know, they have to do their job, and they do their job representing basically the issues, hopefully with integrity and to the best that they can. The complexities of this bankruptcy is what generates the rise and cross.
Wednesday's hearing isn't the only important step in the bankruptcy case. A federal appeals court in Chicago is scheduled to rule this year on whether a $57 million Catholic cemetery trust fund can be used to help pay the victims' claims. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.